From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In 1 week, the WTO has gone from something that no one knows anything about to something that everybody is suspicious of. And it's happened because of a cadre of essentially 20-year-old kids who are willing to risk their necks.
Close to 500 arrests, the city of Seattle is under police siege as the World Trade Organization continues to try to ignore it all. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The battle between police and protesters continued in the streets of Seattle yesterday, even after a zone of more than 50 blocks was declared off-limits to demonstrators and was surrounded by police, state troopers, King County sheriff's deputies, and the National Guard, many wearing riot gear. About 500 people have been arrested. The final numbers are not yet in, placed in city buses, taken to a relinquished naval facility. Police pepper sprayed the nonviolent protesters, even in buses in which they were being held, this according to the Direct Action Network legal team. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union yesterday requested a temporary restraining order in a legal action against the city of Seattle. The ACLU order, which was denied, challenged the city's no-protest zone, which the organization says interferes with the right of people to protest peacefully. This news from Madison, Wisconsin. Yesterday, 14 members of the city's Common Council, joined by the Madison Mayor, Susan Bauman, signed a letter to World Trade Organization Director General Michael Moore in support of the anti-WTO civil disobedience actions this week. The signatories to the letter said they're joining with diverse organizations around the world to oppose the current practices of the trade group, which they believe are a threat to workers' rights, consumer safety, and the environment. Further, they called on President Clinton to conduct a full review of the WTO's impact in a variety of areas, including democracy, the poor, health, labor rights, and the rights of women and children. Northern Ireland entered a new era today as political foes banded together to try and rule in peace after 30 years of armed conflict. Without fanfare but with hope, a coalition of Protestant and Catholic ministers took over responsibility for day-to-day running of the province from British ministers who'd shuttled in and out from London as guerrilla war raged year after year. Martin McGuinness, a Sinn Féin minister in the new cabinet, told the BBC he was working toward the disbandment of the Irish Republican Army, which is his party's military ally. The IRA is expected to open talks with disarmament authorities later today. Yesterday, Russia's foreign ministry gave the United States a protest note accusing an American diplomat of spying and telling her to leave the country. This according to the Itartas news agency. The State Department has confirmed, quote, an incident involving one of its diplomats has taken place, but gave no further details. The embassy confirmed an employee by that name worked in the political section, but declined further comment. Russia said that on Tuesday it had caught the diplomat red-handed attempting to obtain military secrets from a Russian citizen and bearing a collection of spy gadgets to thwart detection. It hoped the incident would not harm its already strained relations with the United States. This news from Nigeria, on the verge of an AIDS explosion that could kill millions and wreak untold economic damage, a new report says today. It is released to coincide with World AIDS Day yesterday, showing overall HIV infection rates in Africa's most populous nation of 5.4%, climbing as high as 21% in the worst affected areas. Like other West African countries, Nigeria has been less severely affected by the epidemic than Eastern and Southern Africa. But its population of more than 108 million means that it already has more people infected with HIV, which possibly leads to AIDS, than many other African countries. The UN General Assembly endorsed a resolution yesterday aimed at pressing the United States to abandon plans to build an anti-missile defense system. The vote on the resolution recommended last month by the Assembly's Disarmament and International Security Committee was 80-4, voting against the draft together with the United States were Albania, Israel, and Micronesia. The members of the 15-nation European Union abstained except for France and Ireland, which voted for the resolution. Hillary Rodham Clinton offered the most pointed attack to date on her likely opponent on Tuesday, condemning Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's policy of arresting homeless people who sleep on the streets and refuse help. Clinton told an audience made up of mostly black ministers, "Our political leaders must be judged on how they treat everyone, including the least fortunate." And that's some of the news at this hour.
Peeking out at the crowd, while right across the street from you, folks are sleeping in the rain. You ought to be ashamed to say you care about people. You make bombs that leave buildings standing, while they lay to waste all forms of life. And all your wise men sit and chat among themselves, trying out their truths on one another. We're dying from the cold, we're dying from the cold shoulder that you turn toward us day after day. We're dying from the cold. It surely is the old young soldier who died.
I'm Robert Way with the National Lawyers Guild. I'm here in Seattle. I think there's an increased police presence. I think we're beginning to live in a police state. This is just an example of the wedge in the crack.
Wait, well, keep moving. That's not far from home. Keep moving. Because I said so. Keep moving.
Oh, that's a good read.
All right, if we're going to play that, then I'm going to get these nice blind officers over here to move you back. Now move back. Move back.
Well, they got about 11 squad cars that they pulled up the street and tried to intimidate the crowd into backing off just by pulling the cruiser in over the top of them. Fortunately, the peaceful protesters stayed peaceful, didn't do violent things to the car, and the police backed off when they found that the crowd wouldn't give up. But what they're going to do now is tear gas us because we didn't give up.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Battle in Seattle. Live from Seattle, I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. Yes, these are the sounds of Seattle. Juan.
Well, Amy, the confrontations between protesters and police went long into the night. Past 2 a.m. this morning in the Capitol Hill area of Seattle, where there were continued standoffs and where everyone eventually was tear gassed. Local residents were complaining. TV cameramen and reporters were not only caught in tear gas, but directly pepper sprayed by the police. Virtually all of us who were out there at one point or another were overcome by attacks that became much more aggressive and also largely without warning this time, because already the city has declared cordoned off this large area, and this morning it's even larger. Now there's a 24-hour restricted area that covers a huge, an even bigger section of downtown Seattle than yesterday. Even though the protesters are much smaller in number, the size of the area, the perimeter, continues to grow. The protesters who have been arrested and are out in this former Navy facility, many of them have been kept in buses for overnight, and the lawyers are complaining that they cannot get to their clients. They haven't been able to talk to their clients for 16 hours. The bails that are being put on people right now for disorderly conduct or trespassing are as high as $2,000 and $10,000 for the ones that have already been processed. So Seattle has decided to crack down severely on the demonstrators, even though the charges against them are relatively minor. The embarrassment caused to the nation before the governments of the world is so great that apparently Seattle is cracking down as hard as it can.
And people should understand, in case they think it is any kind of joyride for the protesters out on the streets, it is very cold and it is raining almost constantly. It's quite a scene, as Juan was just describing. The police will do actions. They're deliberately meant to disorient. Last night, as we were walking through the streets, a dozen police squad cars came around with their lights flashing, with the sirens blaring, as you heard in the headline, and they were just going in circles. And then there were motorcycles coming from all directions, and they would flash back and forth, and the police cars would go back and forth so that people everywhere just couldn't figure out what was going on.
Yes, and the amazing thing is that in quite a few of these attacks, I got caught on one right near the Westin Hotel where President Clinton was staying. Once the tear gas was launched, then police would not allow people to escape down side streets to get away. So you were really overcome and caught by the tear gas, and it was a pretty chaotic scene. And unfortunately, I've seen some of the national press coverage after the first day. A lot of the national press coverage has been saying on CNN and others in other stations that things have calmed down. In reality, the situation has gotten worse because there are smaller groups of protesters, but the police apparently have lost all patience now, and so the situation is actually quite more chaotic than even it was on Tuesday.
And including in addition to the squad cars that will blare their sirens through the streets and flash their lights, there are police on horseback. There are National Guard. There are SWAT teams that are marching through in black with the black ponchos because it's raining, with the riot gear, either holding the plastic shields or they have them on their helmets. To say the least, is a very frightening sight. I was talking to some auto mechanics who were standing outside their shop as dozens of police on motorcycles went by in formation. I said, is this a typical scene in your city? And they just looked and rolled their eyes.
One other point. The vandalism and the violence that occurred on Tuesday has received a lot of attention. Well, apparently a local Northwest United States anarchist group has now claimed responsibility. A small group of about 12 anarchists, I think they're called Supreme Anarchy, has now publicly claimed responsibility for the window breaking that occurred in the afternoon of Tuesday. So as we had indicated, it was a very small fringe group that was bent on creating problems that has now actually claimed credit for what happened.
And we're talking about tear gas right now. But in addition to the tear gas, as we reported this week, a great deal of rubber bullets have been used, perhaps among the first times in the United States recently. Is that right, Juan?
I can't recall of a time when an urban police department in the United States has used rubber bullets against American citizens, no.
Yesterday on local television, they were showing protesters picking up their shirts, and they've got the black and blue marks, serious welts from two different size rubber bullets. You have the tiny berry-sized rubber bullets. I have a number of these, as well as the larger rubber bullets that have been used against protesters. But, you know, Juan, this is an interesting, really, paradigm, a very ominous paradigm, for what is required to enforce the rules of an undemocratic organization. Really, this is what we're talking about. If you want to enforce the regulations of the World Trade Organization, you need a police state. Because as more and more people understand what's happening, in a few minutes we'll hear from Tom Hayden, the California State Senator, who wants to make WTA WTO rulings in California illegal, that they cannot supersede regulations and laws passed by democratic bodies. But if you are going to have an organization like this, a top secret, faceless international organization that can override laws passed by democratically elected leaders, in order to enforce these rulings, you need to have police. You need the National Guard out on the street. You need to have these police on horseback. Because just in this last few weeks, as more and more people start to understand what the WTO is about, look at what the response on the streets has been.
One point I'd like to make. I got into the convention center for a time and talked to several of the delegates, including the foreign minister of the small nation of Dominica. And I was surprised that there was considerable sympathy for the protesters by some of these third world countries. And, of course, Dominica is caught in the big battle over bananas that has raged between the United States and the European Union. And as he told me, 60% of all of the exports of Dominica come from banana sales. And the fact that the United States and the European Union are in a battle where Dominica and Grenada and the Central American countries are not even at the table in the debate over what is going to happen with the European import quotas on bananas. And he says, and do you know what happened when the European Union lost the dispute resolution in the World Trade Organization and we appealed, then Dominica appealed the decision? It was an American judge who was the appellate judge in the World Trade Organization that ruled against the European Union. So many of the smaller nations feel that the World Trade Organization is stacked against them as it exists. And what we've been hearing in the media, that it is the third world nations that are really holding back democratic reforms, is another bit of misinformation that is being spread.
You know, President Clinton is in town. A lot of people might not know this because no one can figure out quite where he is until he is actually there. The police are keeping him and his own, administration, his own people, keeping top secret where he'll show up and what he is about to say. I will say, though, they've managed to get out through these last few days that he will be speaking with some of the protesting groups, with the non-governmental organizations. We haven't found anyone yet who he has spoken to, but that is the word out, I think, to appease the protesters. He did speak yesterday before trade ministers from more than 100 member countries of the World Trade Organization. This is hundreds of protesters continue to occupy the streets of Seattle in nonviolent protests against global capitalism. The WTO limped into its second day of meetings with stunned delegates meeting behind police lines to decide on a trade agenda aimed at expediting global free trade. As we said, the city continues to be in a state of emergency under police siege. A virtual martial law has been declared in Seattle. Hundreds of local, state, and federal law enforcement agents patrolling the streets, shooting tear gas canisters. Close to 500 demonstrators arrested yesterday as the police changed their tactics from the day before. They began making mass arrests. Last night's protest lasted well into the night. One of the people arrested yesterday was Victor Minotti from the International Forum on Global International Forum on Globalization. Now, Victor had just met with the U.S. Trade Representative Charlene Barshefsky, President Clinton's principal delegate at the World Trade Organization. And so, Victor, what happened then? How did you end up getting arrested?
Who I met with was the U.S. Trade Representative's negotiator for the wood product sector, where the U.S. is about to finalize this week what's called the Global Free Logging Agreement. And there were about two dozen forest protection groups there, where we learned at this briefing that they were going to push forward everything that we've been telling them not to push forward, and which has brought a lot of people out into the streets this week for forest protection. And really not having many other outlets, a few of us went down to the streets to tell people about what we just learned. We went up to news cameras to tell them the story. They weren't really interested in the substance of what was going on inside the ministerial. They had orders from above to wait and see for violence to erupt, and that seemed to be what they were more interested in covering. So I went out to a street corner and saw a few colleagues from Food First, Peter Russ at Nanarada Mittal, and started telling them about what we learned, and other people started gathering because people are so hungry for what's going on inside, actually. which is where the real theft and looting and violence is taking place, and that's not being covered. And that was when people started gathering around, some people with video cameras and recorders, just, you know, trying to get some of the details. And there were maybe, you know, two, three minutes going when we got bum-rushed by about 19 RoboCops behind us and chased me all over the place, maybe 100 yards or so, and arrested me. I was, in fact, the only one arrested.
We're going to hear more about this arrest and also about the environmental issues that the World Trade Organization rules on. Victor Minotti from the International Forum on Globalization, when we return here in our live report, live from Seattle. Are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we cover the battle in Seattle. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. And in this day, we're talking about environmental issues and the World Trade Organization. Our guest is Victor Minotti from the International Forum on Globalization, who was arrested yesterday after coming out of a meeting with one of the U.S. top delegates. Is he a delegate? Was it a he?
A she. Her name is Barbara Norton. She is the U.S. negotiator for the Wood Products Agreement, the Global Free Logging Agreement, which we've been trying for almost a year now to stop.
So you came out of the meeting with her. You were in the streets. As you said, the police bum-rushed you. They picked you up.
Well, they, I can't even tell you how many of them came from behind, no warning to disperse. They didn't even listen to what we were doing. It wasn't if we were planning an action or directing anything. I was just telling people what was going on inside the proceedings. They didn't bother to listen to that, and they just attacked us from behind. You know, everybody went running, including me, jumped over a car, and about six of them grabbed me and just dragged me in, and that was it. I was gone for just sharing the details of what was going on inside the meeting. People are so hungry for these things, and there are very few links between those of us in the inside and people on the outside to actually keep people up to date with what's happening.
I understand there was another protest of people that came out of the Methodist Church, and they were told that they would be allowed to stand, many feet away from the Westin Hotel where President Clinton was, if they held no signs and did not speak. And so they each stood as witness to what the rules were by putting tape across their face, hundreds of people in the city.
In terms of some of the issues involved, so far we've been dealing all week with we've had farmers on, we've had labor people on, but in terms of the major battles over environmental questions that are going on at this WTO, or that the WTO eventually will have enormous power over, could you begin to tell us about some of those?
Well, broadly, the WTO is removing government's ability to be able to control natural resource exploitation and at the same time diminishing government's ability to protect the environment. In the forest product sector, we're seeing an expansion of market access so that wood products companies can sell more products around the world and increase consumption and thereby stimulate logging. That's what we're seeing in one of the deals they want to sign this week, called the Advanced Tariff Liberalization Initiative, what we call the Global Free Logging Agreement. The White House has even said this is going to increase logging in some of the most sensitive forests around the world, in Indonesia up to 4.4%. And our friends in those countries are very clear that they do not have the regulatory systems in place, the enforcement, to handle that kind of increased logging, and they're not for this. In addition to that, there are numerous other things they want to put into the next round. What we were told yesterday is that they plan to put into there all of our environmental protections, the raw log export bans, the protection against invasive species, perhaps even eco labeling. And then they're not really willing to defend these things either once they're put on the chopping block. And thirdly, the whole new investment agenda, the MAI, is something that they seem to be more receptive to and are going to allow that to move forward. All of these things have huge implications for protection of the environment. I actually think of this meeting as more important than the 1992 Earth Summit in terms of planetary sustainability.
Well, one of the things that Michael Moore, the head of the WTO, has tried to say repeatedly in recent days is that there is a lot of transparency in the work of the WTO, that there's thousands of pages that people can download from their website to get information. And I noticed in the convention center, I picked up a huge folder with a sort of a summary of all of the dispute resolutions that the agency has been involved in over the past 5 years. But when I started to read the several hundred pages of the summary, I realized that you couldn't understand from that report what country was taking what position, who had said what at a meeting. The summaries of the discussions of these of the organization were so obscure that they really were not putting out in public what were the debates that were going on between the different countries or even what positions they were taking.
We've come a long way, we being citizens and people's groups around the world, since 5 years ago when the WTO was created, to be able to decode these things and put them into popular language to actually explain to people that this means less protection for you and more protection for corporations. It's a constant battle, though, to decode those things. But I think proof is in the streets of how we've gotten better, and people actually get this stuff now.
We're talking to Victor Minotti. He is with the International Forum on Globalization. Patty Goldman is also with us. She's based here in Seattle, Washington, with the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund. Patty Goldman, can you talk about how you're approaching the WTO meeting this week and the issues that you're taking on?
Yes. We've been involved since the WTO has been established trying to defend laws, environmental and health laws, when they're challenged before the WTO. Now, that's a hard thing to do because the WTO is secretive and does not want input from people like us, from the environmental groups, even environmental officials that would like to defend those laws. It's only trade ministers and trade officials that are the decision makers. But we have tried to defend the laws once they've been challenged, and we've lost every time.
Give us examples.
Sure. One of the challenges that occurred under the WTO is to the United States protections for sea turtles. Sea turtles are endangered worldwide. They're recognized to be endangered under international and U.S. law. The number one threat to the sea turtles is drowning in shrimp nets. We in the United States have required our shrimpers to use what's called a turtle excluder device. It's like a little box that the turtles get caught in, and it has an exit door so that they escape the nets. After we required that of our own shrimpers, we applied the same kinds of rules to imports and said that we wouldn't take shrimp imports unless the countries had comparable protections for the sea turtles. But the WTO said we can't do that. And the reason is the WTO does not let countries to treat products differently based on how they're produced, in this instance because the sea turtles would drown. But that's devastating for environmental protections because so much of environmental protections are based on what happens when you cut the forest, catch the fish, or produce the goods in a factory.
Well, part of what has happened, obviously, this week is that last week 95% of the American people didn't even know what the World Trade Organization was. This week, every radio talk show, every television news program is discussing the WTO, and of course the Sea Turtles, because so many of the demonstrators that this week were dressed up as Sea Turtles have probably gotten more attention in this week than they've gotten in years. What is your sense of how these protests have had an impact on the continuing public debate and consciousness?
Well, I think the public consciousness is certainly being raised. There was a poll in the United States that showed 74% of the people polled disagreed with the WTO rule against allowing these restrictions on trade based on production, which is what was underlying the Sea Turtle case. Unfortunately, the Clinton administration has not heard what people are saying, is not responsive at all. It is not acknowledging the need to rethink these rules, to change the WTO so that our environmental laws won't be at risk. It is absolutely resisting any steps towards reform of these principles that jeopardize our health and environmental standards.
What we're getting in the in a lot of the coverage is that here is President Clinton trying to convince these recalcitrant leaders around the world to have reform in some of these areas. You're saying that the administration is doing nothing. So how are we getting this this divide between what is being put out there and what you say is the reality?
Well, there are two types of reforms that the environmental community and others are seeking. One is to change the processes in the WTO so it is not so secretive. And on that score, the Clinton administration is supporting reforms. But on changes to the substantive rules, and the WTO is made up of rules countries agree to follow. They are the rules that the United States has said it will abide by. The Clinton administration is absolutely resisting any change, and they're even denying there are problems.
Patty Goldman of the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund, I have to ask you, this is your city. This is Seattle. You live here. You live here. You work here. What do you think about what you're seeing? I mean, you've been working on these issues for a long time. Now you're working on them in a complete police state. What do you think of the streets, and how does that relate to environmental issues in the WTO?
It has been absolutely shocking to walk through the streets of this city. It feels like I am in some other country rather than my home city. But I agree with what you said. These rules and the system is so anti-democratic, keeps people out, keeps people from knowing what's going on the inside, keeps developing countries from having a voice, that's why people are upset with this system, and that's why there's such a strong response to keep people down.
And Victor Minotti, in terms of the President Clinton, I'd like to get back to him again, because clearly his being here makes these protests even more embarrassing for the United States or around the world, because here is the president. I understand many of the local TV stations are reporting that the Secret Service was furious with local Seattle authorities over their failure to control these protests with the president being in town. But what about this image that the White House is trying to project of him as the great reformer of the WTO?
Well, that's the picture on the front page of the New York Times, President Clinton chiding the WTO. But, I mean, I'm glad we're getting to this big gap between the rhetoric and the reality. And just to spell out really how wide the divide is, Patty, together with my organization and five others, recently sued the U.S. Trade Representative's office for violating the Federal Advisory Committee Act. Right, the way that our trade representative makes policy, that sets our national negotiating position in this country, is they rely on a series of corporate advisors called ISACs, Industry Sector Advisory Committees. They got them for auto parts and chemicals, and the two that I follow are due with paper products and wood and lumber. When we look at these, though, they're chaired by International Paper Corporation, vice-chaired by Weyerhaeuser, Boise Cascade. I mean, you just go down. There's nobody on there for forest protection, nobody there for wood product workers, nobody there for timber communities. And there are even foreign subsidiaries of foreign wood product companies there. So, you know, this is who sets our national negotiating position. And at the same time, these companies go abroad into all the countries they have investments in, and they detail what changes they need to their trade ministers. So when they all get together around the table, they pretty much agree on what the rules are going to be. This is why we call it global corporate government. So, but now we've successfully sued. We've gotten a federal court order for them to change the structure of these things, and they failed to do that. We've been told that they're pushing forward. All these things are going to destroy forests further, yet President Clinton says he's here to save the environment. And, I mean, there's really a big spin that he's put on this that we need to counter.
One of the things President Clinton said yesterday in his luncheon speech is that he was looking at a camera testing a white napkin, you know, just for light, to test the lighting of the room. And so the cameraman was up at the podium holding the napkin out, and Mike Moore leaned over to him, the head of the World Trade Organization, said that could be the flag now of the World Trade Organization, right, the white surrender flag. Do you think that's true? Do you think that the WTO is going to reform this week?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I mean, they're moving forward. I mean, and there's been a lot of delegitimization that's gone on, which is very important. The public awareness raising, that people now know what the WTO is, and they see that so many people care about it to risk their body and so on. But we need to get more coverage of what's going on the inside and what the implications of some of these agreements and decisions they want to put on this week, because that's where some of the real battles are. But it's very difficult to affect the decisions. I mean, but the what they're putting out now is really nothing more than another White House lie.
On the issue of who decides within the WTO on a ruling, people, I think, don't understand the mechanism at work. What is the panel? Let me ask you that, Patty Goldman, of the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund. Who is making the decisions in the case of the environment?
Well, when the rules are negotiated, it is trade ministers who negotiate the rules. But the WTO allows one country to challenge another country's laws to enforce those rules. When there's a challenge, a panel is appointed that consists of three trade officials. That is the requirement. They must be trade experts. If it's a health protection at risk, they do not have to have expertise in health, public health, or the environment, or human rights, or whatever other issue is there. They meet behind closed doors. Only governments can participate. For years, we've been trying to have other views submitted. Often, we don't agree with what the United States is saying, particularly if it's the challenger to some other country's health law. But we're not allowed to submit views to the panels. We've had them thrown in the garbage. We've had letters sent back saying, you can't give us this. And the only time a panel was allowed to receive our submission was because the United States had adopted it in part, and that it only read those parts. So there's no independent voice. And since our government is not often on our side on these issues, it means we are not represented through our government or otherwise.
Who chooses?
These individuals have their names on a list in the bureaucracy of the WTO in Geneva, and then they are selected, offered to the panels. But their one and only qualification is they must have trade expertise.
And it seems to me, for instance, in the conversation I had with the foreign minister of Dominica, that they would at least, when they were going through these panels, and especially going into the appellate part of the process, that they would disqualify judges from the particular countries that are involved. But in this case, it was an American judge that decided in favor of the United States in the dispute over bananas. There are no rules in terms of possible conflicts between the people who participate in these panels?
Well, there is supposed to be a rule that the countries that are directly involved aren't on the panels, although sometimes the disputes have so many countries that express an opinion that then those countries that aren't the direct challengers might actually be represented on the panel. And that happened in the shrimp case, for example.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us. If people want to get in touch with your organizations, Patty Goldman, Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund here in Seattle, Washington.
Yes.
How do they call? How do they get in touch with you on the web?
Our website is www.earthjustice.org, and we're here in Seattle, 206-343-7340.
One more time, the phone number?
206-343-7340.
And Victor Minotti of the International Forum on Globalization.
On the web, it's just ifg.org. And by telephone, it's 415-771-3394.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. When we come back, we're going to speak with California State Senator Tom Hayden. Also, if you want to find out any of these contacts or links to news that you're not going to be getting in the mainstream media on what is happening here in Seattle, you can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and we're joined by California State Senator Tom Hayden, longtime activist who has come to Seattle, I don't know what, to relive your SDS days?
Well, that's not a bad idea, but I'm here partly as a state legislator because according to one analysis, at least 95 California laws are at risk with these new trade rules, including some that I've passed, the consumer issues, environmental issues, health issues, procurement issues. And we were always told by the Mickey Cantors and the others that the federal government would protect our laws. And we would always say, if the federal government was protecting us, why have we passed these laws in the first place? So it's come to this, and I'm here to try to work on California legislation that will be a model for protecting states against the WTO. But I am also here in solidarity with these young activists or rebels who, deserve the commendation of the nation for bringing to the light some of the deeds of this WTO. And if the authorities have failed, again, it's the youth who have the bravery and the energy and the inventiveness to address the issues. And if they, I'm sure, if they hadn't stopped the WTO from functioning, it wouldn't be discussed the way it's going to be. I think they've changed history, or they've certainly changed the history of the WTO forever.
Well, Tom, you know, this reminds me, more than 30 years ago, you and I were both at the Chicago Democratic Convention, and one of the points that I raised in a column yesterday was that unlike the Vietnam War era, when you saw many labor unions and students and environmentalists on different sides of the fence, the amazing thing is, and what's happened here in Seattle, is that all these groups are on the same side of the fence. And if the WTO has done anything, it's managed to unite people's organizations and movements, not only in this country, but throughout the world. And is there anything else that comes in terms of a comparison or contrast to what happened back in Chicago back in 68?
I think you're right that the WTO has brought us together. They just couldn't manage to buy off labor or any other interest group the way they might domestically. And so everybody's left out. Teamsters, tree huggers, whatever you want to call the spectrum, everybody's left out. I think a lot of these movements were born in the 60s. Even affinity groups, these little street activist units, but they've matured. The doors have been opened. They have been at the table. And they're saying, having been at the table, they're still being paternalized. That's very interesting to me. 30 years of experience being at the table and the Sierra Club's feeling excluded, the AFL-CIO's feeling excluded. And so now I think hopefully we get to a point where we go beyond this token reform where you it's all about being at a table. We need real decision-making power, more, not less, vested in these community organizations and human rights and labor environmental organizations.
I wanted to go back to this first point you made about the state laws in California, because this, I think, is beginning to sink home for a lot of people in this country now who did not understand the World Trade Organization before. You said there are a number of laws, some of which you've passed, that could be overruled by this organization, the World Trade Organization, that is not democratically elected, not chosen by the people of this country. How does that work? Can you give us specifics?
You'd need a very long program indeed to explain that. But the essence of it is that if California passes a law saying our procurement policy is going to weigh in against apartheid, we're not going to have any contracts with companies that do business in South Africa or Burma, Myanmar, or something like that, that would be seen as a infringement on free trade and would be struck down. If you say that we're going to require labeling on food, or we're going to require this standard for carcinogens in children's food, or we're going to require warning signs in the workplace about this toxic exposure, those would be struck down as being a California standard that is discriminatory. And this has moved past the hypothetical. The European countries have already started to challenge some of these California laws, so we can't really rely on the Clinton administration to protect us. We have to have a binding mechanism that allows a state or a local government, elected officials, the reasonable certainty that the laws they pass can't be overturned, as you say, by an unelected assembly behind closed doors. That's the next round. It's got to include local and state government. It's a democracy issue. Democracy now, Amy. Not just human rights, environment, civil rights, and so on, but just the what's the function of elected government if you turn over trade to a lot of bureaucratic geeks?
We're talking to California State Senator Tom Hayden, and we're here at the Claremont Hotel, which is a block from the Westin Hotel, where President Clinton is supposedly staying. I mean, no one knows quite exactly what he is doing. His schedule is kept top secret. You can't get any information out of the press office, even as press. As the door opens here in the lobby of the Claremont, the smell of tear gas wafts in and stings our eyes and throats. This is downtown Seattle at the end of 1999. Juan?
Well, Tom, one of the things that interested me when you're talking about the people being left out in the process, I managed to talk to several of the delegates in the convention center from countries like India and Dominica, and they were actually, some of them, very sympathetic to the protesters. For instance, Dominica is being saddled with the fact that this banana crisis, 60% of its total exports is bananas, and yet, as the foreign minister of Dominica was explaining to me, when the United States brought this case against the European Union, over the issue of the preferential banana quotas for Caribbean countries, Dominica wasn't even included in the discussion. It was a debate between the United States and the European Union, and all the smaller countries couldn't even be considered in the battle that went on to decide the issue. And then when they appealed it, He tells me it was an American judge who ruled on the appeal. So many of the smaller countries, and even India, the largest member in terms of population of the WTO, feel that they're not at the table in terms of the decisions that are being made. So what's your sense in terms of the implications of what's happened here for building international ties in terms of popular movements around the world?
I never understood how you could build an international movement again until some of these international forces or international mechanisms started to kind of make it necessary. The Rio Summit on Environment, the WTO. I do think since capital is crossing borders, organizers have to cross borders and journalists have to cross borders. And it's going to be very, very hard because there's such a disparity, even in perception. You know, people, I don't know about the rest of the country, but people in California, including journalists, are very fond of saying the economy is doing well. Economy is booming, some of them say. And every time I hear that, I'm thinking they've managed to define economy, you know, within the border of California, and the suffering in Central America is just deleted. It's not part of the economy that's booming. So this whole idea that Clinton and others embrace about being more competitive is a mental trap, and it's a political trap. You can't really say we don't want to be more competitive, but if you only say we want to be more competitive, it's at somebody else's expense. It's some poor guy's expense or some little country's expense. So there have to be these links. The thing that impressed me at the rally, moved me to tears really, was, you know, the Mexican woman that worked in a maquiladora, the miner from South Africa, from the labor network in South Africa, and you know, it was clear that they were wages behind, dollars behind the American workers on the stage with them, but they didn't want to be treated like a cheap labor market. We don't want them treated that way. And for the first time, I think, in my life, I actually saw at least some glimmer of solidarity or the possibility of solidarity. And when she said, you know, we need an international minimum wage, and 40,000 people are cheering for it, I thought I'd never live to see that day in my life. And I think there's some real possibilities here that people ought to say are positive, are terrific. If we can just stop this lopsided emphasis on privately securing investors' rights, and hopefully that balloon is punctured, and even the investors may be wondering if they have to cut a better deal for the rest of the world. If we can do that and put all these issues on the table, we have a framework for very good, very, very good beginning. It'll take a long time, but I saw some real examples this week.
Well, we had earlier this week on the show farmers from around the world. We had the French guy, José Bové. We had the head of the Nebraska Farmers Union. We had a head of a black farmers group in the South. And it was amazing the degree of the same problems that they were all confronting. The family farms all everywhere are disappearing, and it's the same agribusiness companies that are behind it wherever it is. So, I mean, it's been remarkable the degree in all of these movements, environmentally. I mean, there were Koreans in the streets sitting down, blocking the streets, Filipinos who had come here to join this movement. So that's why I got the same sense. I've never seen a protest of such international character in the people as well as in the ideas that were being brought out.
No, it's too bad that it's not politically being articulated. Bush and Bradley and Gore are probably gone, right? They're just not going to step up and say no further WTO, no further trade pacts without labor, environmentalists, and human rights. And that leaves you with Buchanan, who is conspicuously missing
this week. He's totally against the WTO, but from a very narrow nationalist perspective. And frankly, he doesn't seem to like all the other people willing to join him in the protests. You know, he's really not big on the people of color or the labor unions or the environmentalists. So he raised the issue, but he strands himself by being so far over in the corner that he's not the leader. So we'll have to find ways through all these movements and organizations to keep these issues alive. But they have to be politically resolved. There has to be somebody better than the Clinton administration to take this on, and it's not going to be, I don't think it's going to be the Republicans. So the political potential of this movement is stillborn. It's just not a possibility right now. That's the only thing that disappoints me.
As a state senator, what can you do? What kind of challenge can you make to the World Trade Organization?
Well, I've been on this for a few years, but it's quickened my focus, and I've been talking with Public Citizen, some of the other groups, some of the legal groups, about what can we craft as a model California ordinance that would basically say no to WTO, that California laws will not be overturned. The WTO doesn't like California laws, then let the federal government deal with the costs and the but we are not having a law that we've passed overturned by a foreign and international unelected body. That will set off a challenge to the federal system. But that's already undergoing. It's very insidious that the Mickey Cantors and the Bill Clintons are collapsing federalism already by saying that, by patting our heads and saying, we'll take into account state laws, but we, the feds, will protect you and be there for you in that, you know, that room, that private room. So that's the collapse of the federal system, except in name only. And so we need to find a way for states to assert their rights, even if it then throws it to the courts. And so I will craft some kind of legislation to try to focus the question. I mean, California, not to toot our horn, but we are the eighth largest economy in the world, and we're not present in the World Trade Organization. We're not there at all. And that would go for all the other regional governments, state and local governments, where a lot of creative things are done. The states are usually called the laboratories of progress. You know, you try to reform, create reforms at that level. And we've done a great many things, including the anti-apartheid work in California, that would be erased, that would be not permissible under this arrangement.
When you mentioned the lack of political leadership in terms of the issues of the WTO, I mean, two people come to mind who have been very vocal in the past, Jesse Jackson and Ralph Nader, both of whom have attacked some of the principles and directions of the WTO. But Jesse was absent from the scene this week. And Ralph Nader was present, participated in debates, but I don't think he can be seen as, at this stage anyway, as being sort of a leadership force for the popular movement, because he tends to basically lead the academic discourse and the research, but not to be out front in terms of the public battles.
And Paul, to his credit, Paul Wellstone was here, and he had been thinking of running for president. But let's not give up. What's happened is, in 1 week, the WTO has gone from something that no one knows anything about to something that everybody is suspicious of.
Tom Hayden, the California State Senator, and we'll have more of that interview in our continued series on the World Trade Organization. We spoke with him yesterday in Seattle, Washington, as he was holding a wet rag to prevent against the gas mask. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, Errol Maitland, and Mark Torres, our engineers. Thanks for listening.